Hey, welcome to another podcast from the Morningstar Men's Ministry Fellowship that meets on Saturday morning. We've been in a series entitled Big God, Big Questions. We've been covering some pretty weighty issues, some of the biggest questions that people have about the credibility of faith. The biggest question, the umbrella question for all of these weeks that we've been in the series is what best explains reality as we see and experience it. Is it a solely and purely naturalistic explanation? In other words, did everything come about by means of time and chance and matter, or is there something more behind it? Is there an intelligent force behind the creation? Is there in fact a God? And then we've looked at some of the other tough questions about if there is a God, why are these other things present? Well, today we're going to look at the topic of miracles. For some, it's a no-brainer. If you're a person of faith, you have very little doubt in the concept that miracles can exist. Perhaps you've even personally experienced one. But if you are not, by nature, one who believes in God, well, then you may struggle with the whole concept of miracles. Or maybe you know friends who completely doubt that miracles occur, that they're simply the fabrications of inventive minds or superstitious people. But that intelligent and reasoned people in the 21st century, well, they can no longer possibly believe in miracles, could they? So let's take a look.
Okay.
Well, if I haven't made everyone sufficiently uncomfortable and agitated yet, this is the week. I got to say that this has been difficult, and so my apologies to you for a lot of this material being somewhat disjointed. I would love to have done a more thorough presentation even on some of the previous weeks. It's just that it takes a lot of time to put material together, and then it takes even more time to sort it out, and then it takes even more time than that to figure out how to present it in an organized way. And I don't feel that I've always done that real well week over week on this. Some of the topics that we've covered, honestly, people devote their whole life to this single topic and invest years of their life in it. So I'm sure that I've left some things uncovered. And with that said, is there any big topic? Because we're going to wrap this up. We're going to do a few standalone weeks that it's just one week, one topic, and then we'll move into a summer series. But is there anything regarding this whole big arena of what we'll call apologetics? Is there anything that you feel that hasn't been covered? Some big question that you have, or some overarching idea that you hear again and again and that you don't feel that you have any answers for that you'd like to see us talk about? John, you're really into this, so I'll throw it back to you. Is there anything that you feel, any particular topic that we haven't covered? And before I open it up, I should say that today's topic is miracles, which is another one of those sticking points for a lot of people. Does the miraculous have any credibility? Would be the question.
No, I think it's great. I'm sorry that I missed last week. I had a conflict with a supplier. I had to get a job done last Saturday, but I think it's great. I know that you covered, I believe it was evil.
Yeah, we did cover evil,
which is one of the biggest, obviously, which you probably said last week, that it's probably one of the biggest objections of naturalists. Say, well, there is no God because that guy got killed in a crash and that guy lost his wig and, you know, how that goes.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that was done pretty much.
And it probably wasn't treated sufficiently enough. As a matter of fact, I said last week the one thing, that was one topic that I would like to have spent 2 or 3 weeks on. There is so much material to cover, and in 1 week you just can't cover it satisfactorily. But surprisingly, a few people said, well, who would want to talk about evil? Now, I get that, but
That's one of the biggest arguments.
Right. And it does us no good to burrow our heads in the sand and pretend that there are no arguments against our side.
Right.
The only way that we can be effective representatives of the gospel is to know what other people are thinking and saying.
Let me just real quick. They use Hitler as an example. Some of the SS had on their belts, you know, we're doing this for God. I don't know what the exact German translation was. So, like Hitchens and all those other guys, they said, well, there you go. Well, big deal. So, like I said before, a couple weeks back, we're going to fire all school teachers because one molested a kid in northern Pennsylvania somewhere. You've got to take that into context. You've got to look at what those people were doing. They were just outright nuts. They were just crazy.
Right.
People do things in the name of whatever.
Right.
Maybe not the Harley-Davidson and Harley-Davidson. There are people that have stuff stamped all over their bikes that are not Harley-Davidson. Now, Harley this, Harley that, that's a Harley. That's a clone. It's a wannabe. I think there are a lot of wannabe Christians out there. They really want to be, and their intent. Their intent is not to do harm. They really believe that they're doing what God's called them to do. But if there's no accountability, and there's no way to... There's no oversight for that. There's no one sort of overseeing that thing. Whoa. Slow your roll, chief. That's not how this works. That wasn't what that meant even then. And, you know, a lot of us read through this stuff like, oh, I know what that means. Do you really know what that means? Or are you just saying that because you wish you did?
Let me put that on hold for a minute. You used a good example.
Yeah.
Jim brought out an essential theory. Of the books of Revelation that we've talked about, which book of Revelation would help us to grapple with Jim's thinking and your example? The church, right? God has intended us to function together, and when you detach yourself from the body, which is intended to help filter and sort through ideas and thoughts and help us to arrive at conclusion, this is God's work on earth to help us come together. As a matter of fact, the book that we're going to use for the morning is the book of Acts. Right? If you were to have any objections to miracles, the book of Acts is the place you're going to end up landing. The book of Acts opens with the introduction, and well, let's just go there. I didn't want to start there, but let's just go there. When your mouth takes you places, I guess you have to follow sometimes. In the first book, O Theophilus, I've dealt with all that Jesus began to do and teach. So this is Luke continuing on, and his first book is the book of Luke, so he's talking about this. Incidentally, there are those people, I should introduce this, there are some people who say that Luke is another author's mouthpiece. They believe that Luke did not write the book of Acts because there's some suggestions that maybe he didn't know Paul all that well. Most people, most credible historians, most, I say, still believe that Luke is the one who authored the book of Acts. In the first book, O Theophilus, I have dealt with all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day that he was taken up after he had been given commands through the Holy Spirit to the apostles whom he had chosen. He presented himself alive to them after his suffering by many proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of heaven. Now, maybe somebody has a clearer translation of that. But in two verses, what is Luke described? In my first book, I'd like to tell you about a man who was raised from the dead. I'd like to tell you furthermore about how the man who was raised from the dead made multiple appearances to people at various times and places over 40 days before he was taken up into heaven. Now that's two verses. How many miraculous things are described? So if you have a predisposition toward naturalism and say that miracles cannot exist, then what do you do with the book of Acts? You'd have to, wouldn't you? If in the opening salvo, if the man doesn't even give us time to get a foothold into his writing before he introduces the miraculous, then we have to say, I either believe in the miraculous and therefore I can pursue this book further, or I have no regard for the miraculous and therefore I have to discount everything that's said from this moment on. So you have to make a choice. Now remember, when we talk about miracles, we're still answering question number one. What is question number one? First week's question. What best explains reality? Do miracles provide any explanation, or do we discount them and say no miracles exist? So the first thing we're going to do here is we're going to read some writings from David Hume. Again, you're going to find typos throughout all of these four pages here. I am amazed sometimes when I look at this in the morning how many errors I've made, but it's too late then. So anyway, David Hume lived during the early to mid 1700s. Most of you probably aren't familiar with him, but his influence is sort of like this large shadow throughout intellectualism. And here's what he says. Nothing is esteemed a miracle if it ever happened in the common course of nature. It is no miracle that a man seemingly in good health should die of a sudden, because such a kind of death, though more unusual than any other, has been frequently observed to happen. But it is a miracle that a dead man should come to life, because that has never been observed in any age or country. Let's just stop right there. We've talked about these six books of Revelation, and we've talked about the concept of truth. I've given you some tools through which you can sort this out and filter out what he's saying. Which books of Revelation and which types of truth is he talking about? Well, in concern... Okay, you were about to say something. I'll give you an opportunity. No?
No, I'm just listening.
Oh, now you were... I know that look. That was the I'm going to say something look and I shut you down. Are you sure?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
Nature.
He just needs a little rabbit.
It's personal experience versus the experience of others. You're very close. And here's what he's saying. Because I have not experienced it, and because the people that I know have not experienced, therefore it cannot exist. Do you see what he said? He said, because it has never been observed in any age or country. Now therefore, what would he do if someone were to come forward and say, but I have seen? Well, he answers that. The plain consequence is, and 'tis a general maxim worthy of our attention, that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. And he goes on to explain himself then. And even in that case, there is a mutual destruction of arguments, and the superior only gives us an assurance suitable to that degree of force which remains after deducting the inferior. So what is he saying? I know this is a little bit confusing language, but what is he saying?
Well, you've got two opposing arguments. One of them is going to make sense, and one of them is not going to make sense. You have to believe the one that makes sense.
Right.
Simple.
And he says, to the degree that they compete, he said, essentially, I would have to put them on a logic scale. And I'd only weigh out. And at a certain point, he said, certain amounts of the pro and the con would balance out. And I'd throw all of that out, and what was left would be the truth. We'll read on, and then we'll go back and talk about it. Only gives an assurance suitable to that degree of force which remains after deducting the inferior. When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man return to life, I immediately consider with myself, in other words, he considers in his own mind, whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be, and that should be deceived, or that the fact that he relates should really have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision. And always reject the greater miracle. So again, confusing language, but what is he saying? Which is more probable? That this man actually observed a miracle, or that the man was himself deceived into believing that he observed a miracle, or perhaps that he intends to deceive me by reporting that he did see a miracle? Which is the more likely? Now, in common thought, which would be more likely? That a person misrepresents the truth, or that a person has seen the miraculous? Now, just stop and think about that for a moment. Jim?
You have to go into the psychology of something, because some people are just more gullible than other people. They just are more gullible. They're easier swayed, they're easier influenced. And then you have the other set of people who are like, I'm sorry, I'm from Missouri, you got to show me. If I don't see it with my eyes, Thomas, if I don't see it with my eyes, if I don't see it here with my ears, it didn't happen. Too bad, you're stupid, that's a lie.
Now, I want to back up. Let's roll Jim's tape back to the very beginning, because his opening point was the most cogent there. The opening point was that there are certain people that are more gullible than others.
You
As a little bit of sideline research, you made a great point. Let me build on it for a moment. As a little bit of sideline research this week, I just Googled paranormal. Okay? That's everything from aliens and spaceships to haunted houses and all the other things that fall into that catch-all sort of tub. Paranormal. And as you would expect, the same as there is a scientific camp that attempts to debunk the supernatural, there is a scientific camp, some of them the same people, who attempt to debunk the paranormal. You'd expect that. And so here is their finding. That generally speaking, and there have been done some surveys done, I don't know how thorough the surveys, remember this was a sideline pursuit, so I didn't go into it extensively. Here's what they found. Paranormal sightings and activities are most generally observed and testified to by people who seem to be on the fringes, are in some ways lacking education, and are not well connected with established thinking. In other words, it seems to be the... Here I'm paraphrasing, so this is Glenn interpreting the data. It seems to be the loonies and the less educated that tend to report paranormal sightings and experiences. Most rational people haven't had encounters with aliens, might be another way of saying it. All right. Carry this same line of thinking into the discussion of miracles or the discussion of the supernatural, and what the naturalist will say is the greatest, quote, evidence of miracles seems to be among people and in circumstances where it can't be satisfactorily documented by well-educated people that might have an alternative proposition. That's the story. Now, and you need to understand that so that if you... I'm not saying that I agree with that or disagree with that right now. What I'm saying is that we need to be aware of the fact that when we bring something out as evidence on behalf of God, that there are those who have a counter proposition. John.
And that's what was said about the close to 500 people that saw Jesus after he came out of the tomb. Well, you know, some naturalists say, well, it was mass hysteria. You know, it was hypnosis. Everybody thought they saw him. And they've also given an argument about how uneducated those people possibly were back then, and everybody just thought they saw them. 500 people is a lot of people to fool.
500 people is a lot of people to fool. Now, let me read further on here, and I want you to see if you can pick out a startling piece. You know, some of the best evidence comes from what they call hostile sources. If someone who is not on your side happens to support your argument, that's a really great thing to notice. Listen to what he says. Many different religions have their own miracle stories. Given that there is no reason to accept some of them, but not others, well, aside from a prejudice in favor of one religion, that is, then we must hold all religions to have been proved true. But given the fact that religions contradict each other, this cannot be the case.
Religions don't... The only reason that religions contradict each other is because people got it wrong. That's why religions contradict each other. Because you have to look at the writings of this one and the writings of that one. One, you know, it's the court argument. There has to be the most credible witness. He's the guy you say for your nail in the coffin. Your Honor, I'd like to call eyewitness this guy. And when he goes up there and sits down, the whole jury just stares at him and goes, he's guilty. Like, whatever, like, the defendant is guilty. I'm sorry, why? Because you're such a compelling case. You know what? What if that guy's a liar? But he's just really good.
Gets back to what we said in week one. There's several reasons why people believe a particular thing. One is the strength of the argument. Remember what another one is? The strength of the person presenting the argument.
Some of it's
that if a solid argument in the hands of a poor presenter comes up against a weak argument in the hands of a skillful presenter...
Your audience, because yeah. Some of them really want to believe. And then you have the other side that just don't want to believe. They want to. I really want to believe this because it's advantageous for me. The other side says, I really don't want to believe it because it's very disadvantageous.
But But now here is, and we're going to call him an educated, admittedly it's the 1700s, but his thinking process, like I said, has infiltrated throughout a great deal of modern Western thought. It is amazing to the degree that Hume's work has sort of spiderwebbed its way, and many people point back to still to this day to some of his writings on behalf of a naturalistic worldview. But look at what he says. Given the fact that religions contradict each other, this cannot be the case. How many times have we heard the argument from, we'll call them thoughtless people, that essentially all religions are equal? Now here's a guy who doesn't take much stock in religion, but he's at least taken the time to look at them and says, look, this one contradicts this one on the basis of that and that and that. They don't agree about anything.
Most Christians would never even, absolutely would not even accept the thought that just maybe God doesn't exist. Just maybe. This is all a faith thing, and I have faith that I believe that God exists, that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Save me, I believe that. I cannot tell you that beyond the shadow of a doubt that that is true. 100% true. It's a faith walk. And when we don't acknowledge that, we look like loonies. Because, oh, it has to be true. It just has to be true.
Okay, step back from the ledge, Jim. You've made another good point. I can say something with... There's two words. Let me see if I can find the page here. Yeah, I'm just going to give up. When your handout is too long, you can't even find what you put on your own handout. There's two different words I want to look at here. One is conviction and one is authority. The Gospels describe Jesus as speaking with authority. Why? I mean, they've heard great speakers. Let's not discount the credibility. Let's not discount the skill sets of all the other great presenters that came along before Jesus within Jewish culture. Why do the gospel writers single out Jesus and say he spoke as one and was admired as one and was given credit as one who spoke with authority? What's being said there?
He was able to put the Pharisees in their place.
That's one thing, but that could just make him a better presenter. Does it mean more than that?
He knew the Old Testament.
Yeah.
For somebody from Nazareth who should not have been that inspired in the prophets.
And the way that he interpreted things made sense to them. They were like, whoa, wait a minute, that actually makes sense. Now what do I do?
It made sense, and here's where we're going. Again, you're on to something. First off, Paul describes a situation where here what should be an undereducated man seems to present the facts in a way that is better than the educated people, but it seems to the people, they can't quite put their finger on it, but it seems to the people as if he understands the scriptures as if he almost wrote them.
Knowledge, not faith. Knowledge. He has knowledge.
And so when he speaks with authority, he's unpacking the law, because that's really all he does. He teaches the law and the prophets, but he teaches it in a way that the people have never heard taught before, and it actually starts to make sense, even though it's convicting. Oh, okay, so you're telling me that the scriptures say that I shouldn't have sex with my next door neighbor's wife, but now you're telling me I shouldn't even want to have sex with her? Ooh. But the way in which he describes it is very compelling. See, Jesus spoke not only with conviction, I believe something, but with authority, I know something.
And so do you. That's how he pointed it out. He says, and so do you. You deceive even yourselves. You guys know this is wrong. Because you're trying to compare yourself with God and how he thinks and sees things. So if sin is going to be sin, let's just call it what it is. And you know that when you think about her, what you're thinking and how you're thinking.
But I want to come back to what you said, because this is the point. Sometimes we as believers try to speak with authority, i.e. we know, when what we would be better off doing is simply speaking with conviction. I have a set of beliefs based on certain things. I do not know all things. The scriptures themselves say only one person has died and returned from the dead. I do not know authoritatively from personal experience what happens to people who have died. I don't know that. I have a conviction about it. But when I attempt to impose on people an authoritative view that is only my conviction, I've overstepped the line there. So I have a faith assumption based on a set of facts which have proven true. Exactly what we said about the scriptures. Can we prove all the points of the scripture are true? No, we can't. We simply embrace the parts that we know are credible, and because of that, we can start to take seriously the parts about which we only have trust to go on.
And the very first part you talked about here, the resurrection from the dead, now we have a half a dozen or so children or adults or whatever, so they've been to heaven and then come back. They've returned, essentially, from the dead. Okay, well then, Jesus is nothing special. Because, obviously, there's more than one who's returned from the dead and been resurrected from the dead. And so there's another part of your argument. Well, the thing that you hang your thing on is obviously being disproven right now before you were
cast. They weren't in the grave.
What's that?
They weren't in the grave.
No, they weren't. They were brought back from near death. They weren't brought back from death. There is a difference. However, and this is disappointing, there are people, incidentally, who do research on near-death experiences. Shame on you. Now you've taken me off course. Everything that you've set up until now has kept me on course. It has been very good. But now you've taken me off course. So this is his fault. I accept no responsibility for what I say in the next few minutes.
Responsibility, if we need to do another 3 to 4 weeks on this, we can do that.
Well, I don't want to bore people with this. So
we need to be able to have a partner for you all.
There are people who have made a career of studying near death. I can't put my finger on the guy's name, for instance, right now, but there's one man in particular who's written something like 20 books about near-death experiences. He's been interviewed. He's done tons of interviews. He's done literally thousands of interviews with people who have had near-death experiences. Well, anyway, one of the objections, because many people will point to these, like the little kid story or whatever, and we'll even throw out the fake ones, because I just heard recently that there was some fake one, that there was a book and all that, and then later on he admitted that it was all a hoax. But we throw them out. We discount them and we say that there are still some people who stand by their stories. The stories seem credible. But then some people find, well, there are people who have gone on and they have experienced whatever their version of God is. But they haven't all seen Jesus, is the story. Some have seen this, some have seen that, some have seen the other thing. They all have a common experience, but they don't meet a common person, if you understand what I'm saying. And so those who would say, well, we just have to throw all that out. Essentially what they say is, the mind has all this stuff going, the mind, the brain, the relationship between the two. The brain is the slab of meat, the mind is what the brain does, right? And so they say that all that is simply, there's this fleeting bit of whatever that occurs as the brain is slowly winding down. And so they say, because whatever has been planted in you, your all the stuff that has been put in you over a lifetime, that in the winding down process, right before the switch finally goes off forever, that you experience a collection of things. The fact that you experience something is common. What you experience is due to what's been put into you. Do you understand what I mean? So that we could say that if 1,000 computers were shut off, they would all shut off and have the same sort of set of final assumption things that would take place. But the precise way in which they would shut off would in part be a function of the data that was put into them. Different data, different experience during the shutdown. And that is really what a naturalist will argue is the near-death experience. All right, you took us down that road. No, it's okay. I just want to, if you have never heard, because some people get all excited, giggly, and happy when they hear, oh, that proves it.
Well, you know what? And Paul brought up a good point. It's a near-death experience. You have to acknowledge it as a near-death experience, not in the grave for 3 days dead.
Can I share a point?
You can.
John 10:37-38, Jesus says, if I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. But if I do them, they do not believe me. Believe the works, so that you may know me, know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. The first miracle that I ever saw, I wasn't a believer. I didn't believe in Jesus at all. And most of you guys here know my wife and my kids. My wife and son were diagnosed as epileptic. They were having seizures every day. We've been to Hahnemann, Jefferson, Hershey. My wife had actually gone into a coma. She was having grand mal seizures, which, Dr. Amy, you know more about that. All I know is, as a dad who fixes things, I couldn't fix my family's son. After they had been diagnosed and put on medication, the seizures were still happening. My little girl was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis at 2 years old. We were told by 10 she'd be in a wheelchair. And I couldn't do anything about it. I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in Jesus. I didn't believe in healing or miracles or anything else. And one night I was wrestling with God. This can't be the life that He has for me. Why would you make me a guy who fixes things and I can't fix the one thing I'm supposed to fix? I'm the dad. I wasn't even married. I had both of my kids outside of wedlock, so I had argued with God all day long. I went to bed. I argued even in my dreams. So you're saying the data that you put in, I'm still yelling and screaming. I still remember the dream. And I woke up at 2:30 in the morning. It was thunder and lightning outside, and I went outside and had a cigarette. And as I'm yelling and screaming at God, and I'm not talking like quietly, I am yelling and screaming, "Who the hell are you to do this to me?" And I look up to yell some more, and a drop comes out. Put out my cigarette. I fell on my knees crying because I couldn't do it. I could not do it anymore. I wanted to die. I didn't want to live this life. I don't think I've ever been so scared, not of God, but that I was just a failure. I had failed as a boyfriend. I had failed as a protector. And I heard a voice that said, "Stand up and talk to me like a man," which I knew nothing about the Bible at the time. And I said, I can't even keep a cigarette lit. And I heard it again, "Stand up and talk to me like a man." I said, "God, I can't. I'm done. I don't want to live anymore. Take me home." And in that moment of complete giving up, I started confessing all the sin I had done. And mine were little petty sins. I had armed robbery. I had breaking and entering. I had adultery. I had a lot of sexual stuff to go through. And I just laid it all out. And I asked for forgiveness. I said, "God, I can't heal my family, but I believe you can." It's been over 9.5 years since my son or wife had a seizure. My little girl is 11, plays soccer, hated it, absolutely hated it. But I'll tell you what, it put a smile on my face when she wasn't in a wheelchair. She does volleyball. She's one of the tallest people in her class. 11 years old, she's almost as tall as I am. She should be in a chair, crippled. I don't know what happened. I didn't believe in Jesus, but I certainly believe that my wife and son have been healed, and my daughter. I believe in the words of Jesus that led me to repentance. These people who have never experienced something, my heart breaks for them. The near-death experience, I don't even get into the arguments. I said, "Look, this is what God has done in my life. Take it and leave it." We get stuck in this rut where we feel we have to represent God in such a way. I don't know anything about medical procedures. I don't know anybody else who's been healed of epilepsy, let alone two of them. An ignorant diagnosis. No offense to anybody who loves St. Luke's, but this isn't the kind of hospital I grew up going to. We went to Hahnemann, all the hospitals, CHOP, where they say they're world renowned. I don't know whether they really are. They certainly know better than I do. To have a doctor come in a room and say, "I don't even know why you're here." And then a year later to have a foster son come into our house in a body cast with 12 broken bones, taking him to CHOP, to pray over him and to have him completely healed, and have a doctor come in and throw a body cast in the trash and say he doesn't need this anymore. I didn't believe in Jesus, but I certainly believed in the words he did.
Good story, right? to answer him and to answer the question that all of us might have, because his story sounds compelling. And you would say to yourself, well, who wouldn't believe after hearing that, or who wouldn't at least seriously consider? The reason that God has, I believe, okay, so now I've overstepped authority, so I want to wind this back. I'm speaking from conviction now, not authority. I do not know. I can't speak for why God does. It seems credible to believe that God has placed us together in community because we don't all think the same way, and therefore the same things do not satisfy our curiosity sufficiently. For one person, that testimony just knocks them over. That's it. Case closed. I need nothing more. His experience, described well, is enough for me. For another person, a compelling intellectual case is essential or they can't believe. And so God places us together with small snippets of the overall story. Gives us each different skills. Vinny's extremely articulate and persuasive when he tells his story. It's very satisfying to some people. But there are other people that are given different gifts and different explanatory power. That's why we're in community. Again, one of the books of Revelation, the church and how God interacts with all the church.
But his argument was compelling because the first thing he presented was a world-renowned authority on medicine. And I took them, and there was no healing there, and my diagnosis was this. Then I went here. This is what happened. I chose to be responsible.
While Jim's talking, turn to the last chapter in Acts. Go ahead.
My responsibility was to do the only thing I knew how to do, was to pray for them, continually pray for them. He says, I don't know what happened. That's the part that so many, I don't know what happened. All I can tell you is this. What once was is no more. Will it ever be again? Don't know. But as for me and my family, this is what we believe. Why? Well, because this is what I know. I don't know any more than this, so this is what I believe. I can't tell you 100% what I mean.
Yes.
And that's how the argument gets presented. You know what? I don't know what to tell you. I can only tell you what my story is.
And the amazing thing is, you described that well. The amazing thing is how quickly we slip over the line and transgress from saying, I believe, to I know. Do you know what I'm saying? And when we cross that line, we've lost credibility, but it's amazing how quickly we can cross over it. We do it in the span of a single sentence sometimes.
And we think that that's the authoritative part, I know. Because someone says, I know, they're an authority. Maybe they're just lying to you. Maybe all those X's and O's and parentheses on the chalkboard were just the stuff that he drew there.
Well, okay. Go back up to the top of the first page here. That's the part where it says week 6. I know most of this handout doesn't make sense, but we can be pretty certain that week 6 at the top, that's the first page. Right below that. Belief has influence over observation and interpretation just as surely as observation and interpretation have influence over belief. So, if I don't believe that miracles are possible, how would that influence what I see?
I'm never going to see those. I'm sure they're never going to call it a miracle. It would have to be so compelling. The sun went out. Well, okay. I give. You know what I mean? Like something so compelling. A man raised from the dead after 3 days in the grave. That's compelling.
Well, and we marvel at this. If you read through the book of Acts thoughtfully, and we're going to talk about the difference between magic and miracle in a moment, because I think there's an important point that we have to embrace here. But if you read through the book of Acts, you almost have to rewind every 30 seconds. What did he say? What happened? And it's no wonder that there are different responses to this. We've all heard the charge. Why can't God just make himself more clear? I think it's Richard Dawkins who makes the charge. Well, what are you going to say if you stand before God one day? If there is a God and you have to stand before him one day, what are you going to say to him? And Dawkins' response, almost without missing a beat, is, Well, you certainly should have made yourself more clear and understandable. What would the miraculous look like? In other words, what would God's revelation have to look like for you to be satisfied? Just stop and answer that for yourself, okay? I don't need an answer. Now, do you suppose that if we went around the room, it would be somewhat different for every person? And if you multiplied that by 7 billion plus people, do you suppose that every person has their own version of God? And if the God that they think exists does exist, or the God that they want to exist might exist, would that revelation have to look different?
Or the God that they pray doesn't exist. Because if I had to answer for what I've done, I would be so afraid. And most of the world, Christian population, follows a dialogue that says, we're going to pay for what you've done one day. When you do, well, you better hope God. Instead of the merciful, grace-filled message that those of us in this room enjoy.
But I have to tell you something. Speaking of that, and based on what Vinny shared just a minute ago, I don't know why it was during this series, but there was this time a few weeks ago where, for some reason, I was just overwhelmed with the thought that, wow, I am really a sinner. And it wasn't the big sins. It wasn't like bank robbery or something. It was attitudes of heart. It was I'm kind of better than you are. I'm smarter than you are. I'm this. It was pride. It was all this. And it was almost like this load came down over top of me. And wow, there's really, really a lot of junk inside of me yet. And a lot of stuff that has to be dealt with. And I'm probably going to be dealing with it till the day I die. Now, I don't know why that came over me, but it really was... It was a powerful experience. It was a humbling experience.
What comfort behind that, though?
You have that thought, man, there is a lot in me.
And it's still a lot in me, right? It isn't the big actions. It's just the junk. But the junk inside, the attitudes precede the actions anyway. So the attitudes and the matters of the heart are what prompt the externals anyway. So it is the matters of the heart that are the bigger issues anyway. The externals just reveal what was only going on in the inside anyway. So even if you eliminated all the externals, it's still the issues of the heart that are still there, and they're just waiting for another opportunity to reveal themselves.
And how many people go look at issues of the heart? How many examples? When you talk about sin and like genuine miracle, I know your story. You and I kind of cut from the same stone. I haven't put my hands on anyone in anger in 27 years. That's a miracle. I didn't know how to talk to people. If you came into conflict with me, you were going to buy it. Period, end of story. I wasn't going to talk to you. So, matters of the heart started. I was shown something, and I went, wait a minute. You mean there's another way to live? I don't have to do this every day? I don't have to chase this to Philadelphia? I don't have to carry a gun anymore? And don't get me wrong, I exercise my Second Amendment rights, but not for some reason.
Jim, you're funny.
But you see, there was a change in my heart. I made a mistake in our Celebrate Recovery Words video where I said I didn't have compassion. I had it, but I lived in such fear of showing it for fear of retribution that I would never let it happen. Now I don't care what you think, because I exercise my Second Amendment right. Go ahead. Say what you need to say. I'm going to say what I need to say about whatever it is, and we'll get along. You can be over there, and I'll be over here. I'll let you have your argument. I don't need to. I can't save you, and I'm not going to try to get you saved today.
All right, I'm going to push the pause button on you.
Go.
As usual, Jim has the best thing to say in the first 30 seconds of his statement, and then from then on he starts to ramble. But that's Jim's gift. So what he says in the opening is essentially this, that each believer's life is evidence of the miraculous because I look at who I was and I look at who I am now, I look at the probability that I could have changed from who I was to who I am now, and even though who I am now is nowhere near who God aspires for me to be, who I am now is such an improbable feat considering who I was in the trajectory of my life that I am my own walking, talking, breathing miracle and evidence of God's involvement in human affairs.
And then someone says, well, how did that happen? Because in 9 of the 12 steps, God was introduced to my life. Who is this guy? And who does he think he is getting my job? I'll show you. I'll go on a leash goal mission to disprove God. As usual, God wins.
Thank you for your philosophic comments this morning, Brother Jim. It's always good to have you. Okay. Thank you. Y'all at the last chapter in Acts? This is just a typical response. In other words, how can a group of people, all exposed to the same thing, each come away with their own conviction? If it's evidence, and naturalists will like to point to evidence, right? And I, again, I'm starting to drift toward disparaging even reference in calling them naturalists. But we all tend to think that if I just was exposed to the right collection of facts, surely I'd believe. Let's look at this. We'll start at the 17th verse of the last chapter in Acts, just so we get a bit of background. Paul's in prison. After 3 days, he called together the local leaders of the Jews, and when they had gathered, he said to them, "Brothers, though I have done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. And when they examined me, they wished to set me at liberty, because there was no reason for the death penalty in my case. But because the Jews objected, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar. Though I had no charge to bring against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I have asked to see you and speak with you, since it is because of the hope of Israel that I am wearing this chain." In other words, his belief in the Christ. "And they said to him, 'We have received no letters from Judea about you, and none of the other brothers coming here as reporters have spoken any evil about you, but we desire to hear from you what your views are. For with regard to this sect, we know that everywhere it is spoken against.'" Okay, what's the sect? The sect is those who are followers of the way, i.e. followers of Jesus. And when they had appointed a day, so and essentially there's this time lapse, and he says, well, why don't you gather a group of your friends? Gather all the people together, and we'll spend the day talking about this. So there's this time lapse between these two verses, and then he says, when they had appointed a day for him, they came to him at his lodging in great number. From morning till evening, he expounded to them, testifying to the kingdom of God, trying to convince them about Jesus, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets. And some were convinced by what he said, but others disbelieved. Does anybody have a different translation that has a different word there for disbelieved? That's an interesting word. Disbelieved. What do you take that to mean?
So profound that it's really true. Like, you ask yourself, it's really true. It's so profound.
Well, if some believe and some disbelieve, it seems...
Why is this not believe?
What's that called?
Not believe. Why word?
Okay, so read the full verse so we get it in...
Some were convinced by what he said, but others would not believe.
Ah. Would not believe. In light of the way that Luke brings that out, now let's just consider this as a possibility. So for a minute, we'll simply look at the Bible as a philosophical work. It looks at people and it reports on how people respond. So some believed and some disbelieved or
would not believe.
What is belief then? Is it the inevitable consequence of a set of facts brought to your attention? Or is it a choice that you make about how you will interpret the facts? We want to believe that belief is the inevitable conclusion that all people would come to if they were presented with the facts. But the way Luke presents it is far different. Some people made the choice to believe. Some people made the choice not to believe. And they departed and went away.
One says refused.
That's an even stronger version of it, isn't it? Refused to believe. All right, so that we have enough time for this, I'm going to take this a little bit out of order. But one of the other questions that I have, that I think most thinking people have, is if we're going to point to the miraculous, and we tie that, and remember, all these things are linked together. You can't explore one belief without seeing its connection to other beliefs. That we don't have single and solitary beliefs, but what we have instead is what? A belief system comprised of a number of things that are all interconnected. So last week we looked at the subject of evil. And one of the things toward the end that we looked at is not only is there evidence of evil, which is man's wicked actions against man, but that in some way there seems to be an evil force that's out there. I'm speaking about it in the most neutral of terms because if I rush to Bible terms or Christian terms, to an outsider it can sound really hokey. All right? So let's try to keep it on the down low and the straight and level here so that everybody can embrace this. If there is good stuff that happens because of a good force, could there be bad stuff that happens because of a bad force? And the scripture seems to point to not only the evidence of good works from a good God, but bad stuff that happens from a bad source. This is going to take me a little time to read. If I can find some places to cut it out a little bit, I will. But the question is, could we find the evidence for or people who experience bad stuff happening in their lives because of a bad force? A few weeks after marrying the 15-year-old bride, a devout Hindu named, and I'm going to butcher these words, Chanda Bahan, just trust me, it's a really long word, made some mysterious secret religious vows. As a result of those vows, he abandoned all work and social interaction, dedicating himself to reading the sacred scriptures and meditating. The vows were drastic and life-changing. For 8 years, until his death, he spoke to no one, not even his wife. Most of the time was spent in trance-like states. People recognized his remarkable achievement and flocked to worship him. Seated in lotus position on his board, his mind far away, he would not even acknowledge them. And after his death, he was declared by some to be an avatar, a god in human form. After his marriage, and in the few weeks before taking his secret vow, his wife conceived their only child, a boy named, and we're going to just shorten it to Robbie, because that's easy to pronounce. As he grew up, Robbie earnestly wanted his father to speak to him, to acknowledge him, even once. But it never happened. In spite of this, from the age of 5, young Robbie showed his unusual devotion in that he would follow in his father's footsteps. Fortune tellers, palm readers, and astrologers predicted that he would become a great Hindu leader, a yogi, a guru, a pundit, a sensei, and perhaps a temple high priest. While other children played, he read the sacred scriptures, practiced yoga, or worshipped and cared for his beloved sacred cow. Because of his rapid progress and his father's reputation, at age 11, he entered the temple for a time under the guidance of a brilliant priest. In visions and trances, remarkable supernatural things happened. He experienced unearthly music, saw psychedelic colors, visited exotic planets, talked to gods, and saw horrible demonic creatures depicted, and this is the interesting part, saw horrible demonic creatures depicted by the images in Hindu, Buddhist, Shinto, and other religious temples. His experiences were frightening but real. The head priest was delighted with Robbie's rapid progress. He continued to advance and was widely acclaimed. Though only a boy, he had scaled the heights of Hinduism. People came to worship him, to receive his blessing. They would bring money and gifts to his feet, and he enjoyed the adulation. Yet many things troubled young Robbie. He had been taught self-denial, but found some students at the temple to be gluttons. Furthermore, the young head priest, though sworn to celibacy, had a continuous affair with a beautiful young girl. The people condoned his actions with explanations. It's karma. They have something from their last life to work out together. Although he was meticulous about his vegetarianism, he wouldn't even buy cheese. This is said parenthetically. He wouldn't even buy cheese if the cutting knife had been used on meat. He smoked heavily in secret and couldn't give it up. And he wouldn't buy cigarettes in case someone saw him, so he stole them. And this tormented his conscience even more. No matter how hard he prayed, he seemed to be losing the battle for his soul. Now, isn't this interesting? So here's a religious people, and what do we associate with religious people? Religious people deal in the language of the soul. So shouldn't a person who has devoted his entire life to pursuing his religion find that he's getting more connected to his soul? Wouldn't that make sense? And yet, here's his testimony. He seemed to be losing connection with his soul. For several years each day, for an hour, he would worship his beloved cow. And then one day, it turned on him violently, and for no reason. And he barely escaped death or serious injury. He looked back, and this is reflectively, at the angrily pawing hooves and the hatred in its eyes, and he pondered, why would his God attack him when he worshipped and cared for it with such devotion? Shiva and Kali, and these are other gods, so many of the other gods often frightened him. These would be the gods that he saw in his trances. But the cow was one god that he had adored. Now, I want to pause here before we move on to another compelling fact. You and I might watch something like this in a movie, and what would we call it? We'd call it fiction. He's not describing any of this as fiction. He's describing this as reality. He's describing this as his personal experience. So this isn't just some fictional stuff. In his yogic trances, he frequently met the god Shiva, known as the Destroyer. Always in a seated position with a huge cobra around his neck, hissing menacingly. He wondered why none of the gods he encountered seemed kind and loving. He comforted himself with the thought that at least they were not, or that they were real, and not myths, and this is interesting, like the Christian god Santa Claus. Just thought that was a little humorous. Household family arguments were bitter, and they were frequent. He was troubled that he could so quickly turn from the bliss of long meditation to a state of anger and rage. Sometimes he would take a whip-like branch and lash at a concrete pillar till he was exhausted, and then stand wondering what had gotten into him. Once he took a strap, which was used to beat the family, and lashed it repeatedly against the backs of several of his younger girl cousins, and then retreated in confusion and shame. So this is what's happening in his life. A religious person, dedicated to the care of his soul,
dedicated to finding enlightenment, and yet what is the expression that he has toward a lot of his outer world? He's angry, he's hostile, there's rage. When he retreats into his inner world, the world of his soul, the world of his religious experience, what does he find? Things that scare him and terrify him. Now, we could all dismiss this and say, well, this is just the irrational babblings of someone. Or we could at least for a moment set aside that and say, what if this is real, and what if he's recording for us real and valid personal experiences? His non-Hindu fellow school students taunted him and mocked his beliefs. If everything is a god, did that mean that his god is a fly, an ant, a stink bug? And if he believed all life was sacred and would not eat animals, what about the bacteria he killed when he boiled water? His answers, such as, "You only see the illusion but don't see the one reality," were powerless, and he wondered about the need for his faith to be practical. In other words, is there some... If religion is good, shouldn't it have benefit for the people around me? And it seems like not only do I live in torment, and the more enlightenment that I acquire, the more torment that I experience, but not only is that true, but it seems like the more enlightenment I experience, the more torment I inflict on everyone in my world. Is that just someone's imagination, or could there be something real to that? Some holy men for a fee would bless lottery tickets. When the people didn't win and asked why not, they were told, "It's not your karma." The holy man became rich and the people stayed poor, and so he wondered about this. Let me come to the part that is perhaps... Here we go. His deeply spiritual Hindu mother once advised him, "If you are ever in trouble and nothing else seems to work, there is another God you could pray to. His name is Jesus." One day he was walking through a beautiful vegetation, admiring the flowers and the birds, when a huge, thick snake confronted him, remarkably like the one coiled around the neck of his god Shiva. Paralyzed by fear, he could not flee. A sheer rock wall lay behind him. The snake was close enough to touch, and it drew back its head to strike. Remembering the words of his mother, in desperation he cried out, "Jesus, help me." To his utter astonishment, the snake dropped to the ground, turned around, and slithered off rapidly into the jungle. Trembling with shock, but also with gratitude to this amazing god Jesus, he was astonished that he had never learned anything about him at the Christian primary school that he once attended. That's interesting. On another occasion, he had an appendix removed. A close call. It had almost burst. But feeling better on the third day, he was allowed to go to the toilet alone. On returning, an excruciating pain struck his right side and the room began to swim. Remembering his mother's words again and the snake incident, he cried out, "Jesus, help me." Though no one was there, he felt a hand grip his arm, and the darkness lifted. Every twinge of pain vanished, and a remarkable feeling of well-being surged through him. A strange calm descended on the room, and he fell into a deep sleep. It's interesting, that's the only time thus far that he has described any peace or calm. When he awoke, a Christian tract lay on the bedside table, the first he had ever seen. It moved him deeply, but with so many other gods to worship, he forgot it. He was torn between two irreconcilable views. One was an instinct that he'd had since a child that God was separate and distinct from the universe that he had made. The other was the Hindu teaching that God was everything. Creation and creator were one and the same. His experience in meditation agreed with the second view. But after hours in a trance, it was difficult to face the everyday world of joys and sorrows and conflicts that they brought. He'd been taught that there was only one reality. Did that mean that Brahman was evil as well as good, death as well as life, hatred as well as love? That made everything meaningless, life an absurdity. Furthermore, if good and evil were the same, then all karma was the same and nothing mattered. So now here's the deep spiritual man, and he's moving into some philosophical questions. Listen to what he says. Whenever he asked his teachers this question, the answer was, "Reason cannot be trusted. It is part of the illusion." He was not satisfied. Once in a blind rage, he turned on his aunt, and when she accused him of being lazy, "Just like your father," scarcely conscious of his actions, he grabbed a set of barbell weights and swung it like a baseball bat at his aunt, aiming for her head. But his frantic cousins managed to grab the other end of the weights, and they fell smashing to the thick concrete. All three were stunned. Rabbi ran to his room, locked the door, and cried for hours. He had preached nonviolence. He would not even step on an ant. Such was his respect for life. How could he have done this terrible thing? And how did he manage to lift the heavy weights? At night he crept out to check the barbells. He could not even raise them off the ground. Who were these strong gods that he had invited into himself? Would it happen again? He stayed in his room for days, emerging eventually to a very tense household. Now, I could read on here, but let me get to his end point. Eventually, he has an encounter with this Jesus that's a very personal one. And he surrenders his life to this Jesus. Subsequently, he went to, and this is, I think this is about the close. Subsequently, he went to Europe and worked with drug addicts and young people on their way to investigate the religions of India. He was astonished to find that their drug-induced hallucinatory experiences were identical to those he had experienced in meditation and recognized demonic forces behind them. Now, this is not one of our Christians reporting on demons. This is someone who has come out of this experience and says, it seems to me that there are two definite different forces. In other words, this is not a Christian reporting on Christian activities. This is someone coming from the other side and reporting, this is what I experienced on the other side. It's an altogether different testimony. Finally, at a lecture at Harvard University, he was once asked, you have turned from Hinduism to Christianity. How would you react to someone in your present position who turns to your former position? And his reply, I would never be able to understand how anyone in my present position could ever turn back to my former position if he were really in my present position. The summation of that would be, if someone once comes to know and experience Christ, I couldn't imagine them ever going back. Did you see the number of things that were present in the story? He described evil forces as if they were not magical or mystical or something from the imagination, but that they were very real. He described strength that wasn't the result of a crisis, just mere anger. It wasn't like lifting a car, you know, at an emergency. We've all heard about those things. But this was just a little bit of anger. And it inspired him to do things that would be beyond his physical force at a normal time and do them in a destructive way. If you think about them merely as story, for a moment set aside your beliefs about the gospel as inspired and look at them merely as story, as you would if you were to read the newspaper. Think about the number of times that demonic forces are associated with great strength. About the times when there are people who are under these influences are able to break chains. About the way that they seem to control people's bodies. Now, if you look at them as simply accounts, as people's, this is what I saw. I don't have an explanation for it, but this is what I saw. And you look at it as nothing but that. And then you compare it to this, written 2,000 years later. What's the conclusion that we might draw? That just the same as there is a good force that acts on behalf of people in good ways, there seems to be an evil force that acts on behalf of destructing and destructive things. So if you want to use the miraculous argument, here's the point. If there's good, there might be bad. And we should be able to find evidence of bad miraculous works in the world, and it seems that we do. Comments before we move on? Yes.
When you look at miracles, maybe our interpretation of what we understand and what we know may lead us to a conclusion that it is a miracle when it may not be. I mean, for example, magic. You have an illusionist. It doesn't magic trick. It seems almost impossible that you can do a magic trick.
Are you reading my notes, Scott?
No. But I mean, but once you know the trick and you see it done by an illusionist, not so special. You know what what it is, you know that it's not an impossible feat that they've done. And likewise, if you don't know the trick, you don't know the secret to the trick, you can watch that illusion over and over again, and it's still just as amazed how it's done.
While Scott continues to talk, turn over to Acts 3. You made a nice segue there. Thank you.
I mean, so having the experience of knowing how the trick is done gives you a different perception of the reality of a miracle or not, or the belief of a miracle or not. So, again, going back to the choice, you want to go to a magic show, you choose to be inspired by the performance. If you know the trick and you still go to the magic show, that's a choice. Or you may choose not to even go at all because you already know that there's no big deal.
Alright. I first want to pose a question. Does God believe in miracles? Is anything miraculous to God? And my position on this would be no, because God being the creator of something, when He steps in and fixes something, have you ever taken your car to the shop if you don't know anything about cars and they do something and you tried to fix it and you couldn't, or had a problem with your computer and you couldn't, and somebody else comes in and they just fix it and it's all better? Was that miraculous? It really wasn't, was it? It might have been amazing. It might stump you as to how it was done, but it really wasn't miraculous or amazing, because somebody who actually knows how the thing works can step into the middle of the thing and make a repair on it, and it's all better. So, when we describe miracles, I think we are describing a set of circumstances as they appear from our side of the divide, not from God's side. Is it really miraculous when the creator of things steps in and makes an adjustment or fine-tunes something that's gone out of balance in some way in his creation? Probably not, any more than the person who built a car. If Henry Ford were to build a car and it wasn't running right and he makes some tweak and the engine runs fine, is that miraculous? No, it's simply the person who created the thing making a fine-tuning of what is already there. So when we describe a miracle, we're describing simply what we don't understand. And that brings us to the next question before we delve into Acts 3. If we remove the miraculous, and we're learning more every day, right? If you were to take a person who was born in the 14th century, or say, and we were to, through time, the miracle of time travel, bring him into the current situation, what would he describe? What would he see? How amazed would he be? And wouldn't we look a lot like gods? The things that we do every day, wouldn't we look amazing to him? Of course we would. There's this dangerous position, I believe, between the ancient world and our world. And I suppose it's probably going to happen dozens more times, barring Jesus coming back and establishing a new kingdom. I suppose it will happen again. There's a point where you know nothing about something. And when you know nothing about something and see it, you stand in awe of it. And then you get a little bit of knowledge about it. Not quite enough to really understand all the workings of it, but you get just enough knowledge of it, and then you start to be suspicious. Kind of like marriage. No, Scott, not at all like marriage. And if it is like marriage, we don't have enough time to talk about that today. And then we acquire more knowledge, and it starts to make sense. Now, I'd like you to think about that in the context of what the natural has discovered. There was a time when humanity essentially believed and ascribed everything to the power of the gods. You couldn't predict the weather. You didn't know anything about the weather. You didn't know that much about natural events. And so everything, if the sun shined today, it was because the gods dragged it up across the dome of the sky and dragged it back at the end of the day. If a cloud came, it was because perhaps on the invisible side of the cloud, the side that we couldn't see, God was riding across the top of the cloud. They didn't have an explanation for anything. They didn't understand anything. And so they could believe almost anything. Enlightened people sometimes point back to them and say, see, they were gullible. They could believe anything. And then we became a little bit more sophisticated and we understood just a little. Have you ever heard the phrase, he knows just enough to be dangerous? And isn't that the condition that humanity is... Isn't that David Hume's condition? He knows just enough to doubt what he sees, but not quite enough to understand what he sees. Paul and I had a lively interaction here the other week where he brought out the idea that, yeah, there was a time when unaided, what I'm going to call unaided Darwinian evolution as a theory started to make sense because the model of human life was essentially very simple. And it wasn't all that complex. But as we've come to understand more of the information coded within one cell, we stand in awe and amazement. It's far more complex than we understood before. And now again, with more information, it seems less probable that it could have arisen from pure chance and time. A little information in the middle is a dangerous place to be. More information on the end seems to show us more. It relates directly to the magic versus miracle thing that we're going to look at in a minute. John.
This is the hope of the naturalists, or we'll say the non-believers, or maybe even the agnostics, is that someday the scientists are going to find out so much that they're going to figure out that, yeah, it did start, a bag fell off the shelf at Walmart, and boom, here was the world. You know, that's their faith, and that's their hope, is that because of the fact, just as you mentioned, that we've learned so much more. You know, that's what they're pinning their hopes on, is that someday scientifically they're going to find a reason for all of this that's going to come from a scientific standpoint and not a theological standpoint. That's their hope and faith.
Okay. Now please remember, exactly like the influence that David Hume has had, there is a point in human history in the West where we knew a little. So I want you to step back from this and look at the really, really big picture. That we are today under the influence of thinkers who rose up beginning several hundred years ago, and their influence has permeated even modern thought. And don't discount the fact that people who are 200 years dead are still influencing the way we think today. Don't think that's not possible. It certainly is. When you read the scriptures, do you read it as magic or do you read it as miracle? Because miracle actually has an explanation. Magic doesn't. The mystery of magic, exactly like you said, is that you can't explain it. Well, unfortunately, most believers read the Bible as if it's magic and they never stop to ask. We're going to look at a story, and I think we're going to look at a little key clue that Luke gives us here. We're going to start at the beginning of the third chapter. Now, Peter and John were going up to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour, and a man lame from birth was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, that is called the Beautiful Gate, to ask alms of those entering the temple. Seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, he asked to receive alms. And Peter directed his gaze at him, as did John, and said, "Look at us." And he fixed his attention on them, expecting to receive something from them. But Peter said, "I have no silver and gold, but what I do have, I give to you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And he took him by the right hand and raised him up, and immediately his feet and his ankles were made strong. And leaping up, he stood and he began to walk and entered the temple with them, walking and leaping and praising God. And all the people saw him walking and praising God and recognized him as the one who had sat at the beautiful gate of the temple asking for alms. And they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had just happened. And that is everyone's response, filled with wonder and amazement. Well, in preparation for this, I have to tell you honestly, the book of Acts is a real tough book to read. For me, it's a tough book to read. It's an amazing book to read. Because I always ask those questions, the kinds of questions that have to be asked. How many of you have had a young child and been the parent of a young child and been in the home while the child learned to walk? It's a rather messy business learning to walk, isn't it? As a matter of fact, while we take it for granted, learning to walk is such a difficult thing that until recently, it was one of the big stumbling blocks for people building robots. To create a device that could actually walk, even on level ground, let alone navigate stairs, was one of the greatest challenges. I think they finally arrived at a point where they have devices that can walk on their own. I think they may even be able to go up and down stairs. Somebody may be able to provide a little bit more information for that. In other words, when we make the sort of semi-joking, derisive comment, well, he can't walk and chew gum at the same time, there's an amazing amount of information that has to be processed on a moment-by-moment basis in order to walk, let alone chew gum. And to do both at the same time is pretty amazing, isn't it? Now, I want us to go back to this miracle, because what do we focus on in the miracle? The man was what? Well, don't look at me. The answer is in the text. Yes, he was. What does that mean? He couldn't walk. But what do we know about walking? That walking is both a physical function and a mental function. So simply because you could walk physically doesn't mean you know how to walk mentally. Isn't that curious? Just because the man is now physically restored. In other words, the joints, the bones, the ligaments. Paul could do a far better job of describing all of that stuff. Doesn't mean that he knows how to walk, let alone how to jump. See, we in an enlightened age that understand the complexity of this process have to ask, how does that happen? But then look at this. Verse 11. Because we paint a picture in our minds of this guy, it's like, poof. That's the magic. That's the magic version of Acts. Poof, it's all better. And the guy goes off skipping to the music of, I don't know, some play of the 50s, right? And all is good. But look at verse 11. While he clung to Peter and John, all the people, utterly astounded. Now it starts to make sense. He has the strength to do things. Have you ever watched a 2-year-old that's just starting to walk and they seem to have the strength and they jump a little, they move a little, but it's pretty awkward and ungainly?
It's 1.
Huh?
1-year-old.
Is that what it is? See? Paul has already corrected me. Really? Is it that early? Okay. It's been a while. Give me some slack, okay? It's been a while since they were young. Doesn't this make a lot more sense now? When we look at it, we in our minds have the magic version of the book of Acts. The miraculous is actually more believable. Now he's equipped with what it takes for him to walk, but he's still going to have to go through the process of learning how to walk exactly like you and I. This is the challenge that all of us are confronted with. And if we want to be effective representatives, we don't want to look at the magic version of the Bible. We want to look at the miraculous. We want to look for the small and subtle clues and cues that there is something going on behind the scenes. Well, we still have another question to ask here.
Yeah, I just one point about that.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at that miracle taken by itself, it isn't that much meaning. But when you look at the purpose of the miracle, why God did that miracle, and the discourse that occurs in the following verses of Peter addressing the people who saw this miracle and going through the whole notion of the prophets and the purpose of the prophets pointing to Jesus Christ, you know, then, I don't know, for me, that miracle doesn't seem too much as a miracle, but something for God's purpose.
Turn over to the last side of your second page. The miraculous seems random and inexplicable at times. One person receives a renewed body while another doesn't. Why? One person is given a representative gift of healing and another isn't. Let me take us to that. Acts 8. Incidentally, Paul was spot on, and we're getting to that. Let me see if I can find the right place. Okay, so we'll turn over to Acts 8. We're going to go to the 4th verse. Now, where those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Okay, so this is after the stoning of Stephen, the start of the persecution of the church, and this is kind of like a new chapter in the church, not in the Bible, but a new chapter in the church's history. And there arose on that day great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Devout men buried Stephen and made great lamentation over him, but Saul was ravaging the church and entered house after house, and he dragged off men and women and committed them to prison. Now those who were scattered went about preaching. Philip went down to the city of Samaria and proclaimed to them the Christ. And crowds with one accord paid attention to what was being said by Philip when they heard him. And they saw the signs that he did, for the unclean spirits, crying out with a loud voice, came out of many who had them. And many who were paralyzed or lame were healed. So there was much joy in that city. Now, wouldn't you think that a man who is able to be, and we're going to call him God's agent in that place and time, and able to be the lightning rod, if you will, through which the miraculous flows, wouldn't you think that that would cover all miracles? Turn over to verse 14. Now when the apostles at Jerusalem heard that Samaria had received the word of God, they sent to them Peter and John, who came down and prayed for them, that they might receive the Holy Spirit. For he had not yet fallen on them, but that they had only been baptized in the name of the Lord Jesus. Okay, and so we know from having read through the book of Acts what the baptism of the Holy Spirit is. People start to speak in tongues, they experience these different gifts that they hadn't had before. Now how is it that Philip is able to be God's agent to extract evil from people, to heal people, and yet he's not able to pray a simple prayer that invites God's Spirit to fall on these people? How does that happen? Isn't that interesting? Why is it that God chooses to disperse his gifts widely so that one person's able to do this but not that, and vice versa? More moving to do? Huh? Oh. More bills to pay. Again, if you read through this book thoughtlessly, looking for magic, you miss some of the explanatory power. There's deep questions that we have to ask. And so behind this is not a magic show, but there's particular purpose and function in every miracle. This is what Paul was trying to bring out. There's particular function and purpose in every miracle. In other words, it is not only God's intent to bless a single man. It is God's intent to do something that causes other people's curiosity to be aroused. So if you turn back to the rest of the story, now we'll turn back to Acts 4. So the event, the miracle, and the behavior of the guy following the miracle, the shouting, the dancing, all of this other stuff, causes a lot of curiosity, we'll say, within the temple. And a lot of people are drawn to this. And so Peter takes the opportunity to say, don't look at us as if we're gods. And I'm paraphrasing Peter here. Don't look at us as if we're amazing. We didn't do this. Let me tell you the power inside of us, the agency of God who has allowed us to perform this miracle. And let me tell you about him. Now chapter 4. And as they were speaking to the people, the priests and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them, greatly annoyed because they were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. And they arrested them and put them into custody until the next day, for it was already evening. But many of those who had heard the word believed, and a number of the men came to about 5,000. Well, here's the question. What do you do about the miraculous when you don't want the miraculous to be so? What if you have an agenda in life and you want your agenda to follow through and you don't want miracles to be true? Because if miracles were true, remember what we said, you don't have isolated beliefs, you have a belief system. If I had a naturalistic worldview and all of a sudden I were confronted with a miracle and I had a choice to make, and I chose on behalf of the miracle, what would that do to my belief system? How many spider webbing connecting beliefs would have to be dismantled and reassembled in a different way? Your entire worldview would have to be blown apart, wouldn't it? Sometimes everything that you've spent 30 or 40 or even 50 or more years of your life building up into a solid foundation would have to block by block and brick by brick be disassembled and rebuilt. Is it worth the effort? That's a question, isn't it? That's a real question. Here he says, then Peter filled with the Holy Spirit. Now they are before this panel of people, these leaders. They're brought out the next day. And interestingly enough, they didn't just arrest Peter and John. You know who they arrest? The crippled dude, too. They take him along for the ride. So he spends the night in jail. He must have been so happy. Well, he said, boy, at least when I couldn't walk, I could go home at night. Now that I can walk, I have to spend the night in jail. This is really great. And when they had set them in the midst, they inquired, by what power or by what name did you do this? Then Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit, said to them, rulers of the people and elders, if we are being examined today concerning a good deed done to a crippled man, by what means this man has been healed, let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified. And he just had to throw that in. Right? He just had to throw that in. He was not in the business of making friends that day. Whom God raised from the dead. By him this man is standing before you well. This Jesus is a stone that you rejected. Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, and they perceived that they were uneducated common men, they were astonished. And they recognized that they had been with Jesus. But seeing the man that was healed standing beside them, they had nothing to say in opposition. I don't want to hear this. I don't want your worldview. And yet I see this thing over here. What do I do with conflicting facts? Now this is a question that everybody has to answer. So have you ever asked the question, you now on the theistic side of things, have you ever asked the question, well, when they said, why can't they just believe? How could they not believe? Have you ever asked that question? How could you not believe? Have you ever read the book of Exodus and said to yourself, how could they not respond favorably to God? How could they not believe? Well, here it is. Again, what do you do when what you want to believe conflicts with the evidence you see in front of you? And we want to think that everyone would just fall on their knees and say, oh, I see it now. I get it. Is probably not going to happen. Sorry, when you turn your phone on, there we go. I don't normally have my phone, but I needed to read, so my apologies. And here's what it seems. They bring them back out and says, but in order that it may spread no further among the people, let us warn them to speak no more to anyone in this name. So they called them and charged them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. When I can't embrace the belief, when I don't want to embrace the belief, what do I have to do? Just squelch it. Don't talk about this anymore. We have a way we want life to be. We have a construct for life the way we hope it will be. Don't confuse us with your contradictory evidence or beliefs. We have the power, you don't, so therefore you be quiet. Do we see evidence of that today? We know you don't. You just be quiet. I think the one thing that I'd like to leave us with here is something that we have looked at again and again. That belief is not so much based on facts as it's based on ideology. And once we've convinced ourselves of a certain ideology, we don't like to have to deconstruct it. And the other thing is, when we have these conversations, I don't know if you've ever had a conversation with a person who believes in a different way, but when we have conversations, there's something inside of us that just rises up. And have you ever said to yourself, boy, I want to lose this argument. I really want to look like a fool. We don't do that. We want to win the argument. And when do we want to win the argument? Come on, you know when. We want to win the argument now. We want to win the argument today because we don't like to lose. If it has taken a person 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years of living to accumulate the blocks of the foundation of his belief system, how long should it take for him to deconstruct that belief system? Could it take years to do just the same? The story that we just read about the guru guy? How long did it take for him to question his belief system and deconstruct it and be introduced to a new belief system? And then, right, did he fall on his knees and say, "Thank you, Jesus, I want to know you," the first time that he had the encounter with the snake? No. It was just one piece of evidence. It was a long process from going from "I believe this" to "I'm going to disassemble this belief" to "I'm going to reconstruct the belief based on this." And I think all of us as humans have this tendency, even when we read the scriptures, we see people who just, they believe in Jesus just like that. But why? It was already in their frame of reference to embrace a God. It was already in their frame of reference to accept that God that could do miracles. So when Jesus shows up, it is not that far outside their frame of reference to believe that a God who could do miracles would send a prophet who could do miracles in His name. It wasn't a long leap. For a naturalist, it's an extremely long leap to believe some of the things that we're asking them to believe. And so it's not as obvious as we want to think that it is. That's all I got for you. Oh my word, why didn't somebody stop me sooner? It's 10 minutes after 9.